2002, Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 276, a discussion of the film Chasing a Good Day to Die, featuring Paul Swenson, Paul Larson, and Terry Holland.
I will be speaking. Oh, something is happening. There is amplification. As I mentioned before the film, Terry Holland, the producer of the film, wants to be part of this panel discussion. Terry has a relative who is ill and is out of town. I have asked Paul's wife, Ann Larson, to also be part of this discussion. And Paul pointed out she may be busy selling videos, so if you want to keep her busy, you could do that. But you're asking me. Well, we'll see about that. But the videos are available right for sale today.
Right. On the table back there, you can help yourself. I'll take check. It's $24.95. You make them out to Terry Holland, who's the producer. So if you want to, you can serve yourself.
The serve yourself video sale.
You have questions, I'll help you.
As with the new genre of film, which is called a film essay, we have a new genre of video sale. I've seen this film now a few times. I saw it at Paul's home for the first time, but it was a different incarnation of the film. It was, I thought it was a staggeringly powerful film in its former incarnation, and it's been changed considerably since then. And it's interesting to see that, like any piece of art that goes through transformative processes, that something emerges from the center of the film and becomes so powerful. That is, with any powerful piece of art that is refined and sharpened and made more central to what communicates with us. And that certainly happened with his film. And I don't know where to start this, but I'd probably like to ask Paul and Ann to discuss first. There is the experience in the film that is made clear as to how the lives were changed by the processes described there. I want to know how the film itself, the making of the film, what effect that had both in their family and in their continuing life as time went on.
It was hard. It was really a long process. It was many years of work and sacrifice. And if any of you have ever been involved in a big project like that, you know that it's very consuming. And that's really the only way to get it done. It was the only way for Paul to do it. And he had a few partners, some of which were very supportive, others who kind of fell by the wayside over the time. And he was left to do an enormous amount of it himself, some of which he had no knowledge of how to do, and he had to learn. Ended up doing almost all the editing himself, which he had never done before. So it was, I have to say, there were times when I did resent it a great deal, the sacrifice it was for our family. And the making of the film was like a whole nother process after the ceremonies. But I know that Paul felt, it was a spiritual experience. Paul felt very moved spiritually to make this film. He was not after some sort of ego gratification, and I think you'll see how he humiliates himself on the screen, that he has nothing. You know what I mean? I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of him in this film. I have no regrets about what he says in it, but it took a lot of personal courage, and there are some people who have accused him of egotism to be on it so much and to have it center around him so much, and that was not how he started out, was with that idea. It just began to be clear that a lot of people were interested in his story and that his story was a good introduction to this whole process. So It was a huge sacrifice, and I have to say I resented it tremendously at times, and our children did too. So, but I don't regret it at all. He felt completely spiritually moved to make the film, kind of made an offering to God to say, I am so grateful for what happened to me in this ceremony process. Now what can I do? And it was kind of like, oh, you want to do something? All right. We'll really challenge you here, and if you want to be challenged, make a documentary film with very little money and all that.
Well, I don't answer questions too well, actually. I like a lot of time to think it over and then to manipulate the whole thing. When I was throwing up out in the middle of the circle of all these people, I thought, I have no pride left. And then when we made the film and I put some of those things in it, I thought, I really have no pride left. I'm not quite sure what to say. How did it change us or something like that? I thought a lot more about what had happened during the process of going through the ceremonies. And having to try to reformulate it as a film and tell the story, figure out a way to tell the story, I think at least intellectually sharpened me a great deal on what happened in those teepees and sweat lodges. I think at this point I've come away with quite a different perspective on the world, period. The film in some ways was a test as to whether what happened in those ceremonies was valid, because we were hit with every type of roadblock imaginable while we made the film. Just one thing after another, our computers continually broke down. We were told by a Mayan spiritual leader that our computers would probably have trouble. And
the dark forces would be out.
And he was right. We had nothing but trouble. They replaced motherboards multiple times, couldn't fix the computers, Finally, Apple went right to the corporate top, and they finally decided to replace the computer, got beyond that, finished an early version of the film, took it into one of the local places, has big computers and everything like that, loaded it onto the computers, and their whole system crashed. They'd never had that before, and they spent the whole day with their whole system crashed, apologizing to me. And I sat there just kind of, it's okay, if you persevere, you'll get these things working again, maybe one day we'll write a little thing on trying to make this film. But the making of the film and what happened. But anyway.
I've heard you describe this before, but probably not many of these people have. The film itself was made long after the initial ceremonies took place, so how did you get some of the footage you got?
Well, that's why, I don't know if everybody was in here at the beginning, but that's why we had this debate at the U. Is this a true documentary or not? And because it was, a lot of it was made after the event, and I'm a narrative film person anyway. I teach at the U, I teach screenwriting, and my perspective was, well, we'll make a film as though we were all sitting around a fire one night, and we're going to recount what happened in this event, or these events. So it became kind of a strange mixture of narrative filmmaking and documenting, because some of it is on the spot, at the moment. Some of the images you saw were images from ceremonies going on at that moment. Some of those people were deep in the pit of something, struggling for their lives. One of those ceremonies, the one that was outdoors up in the woods, there was a heroin addict there who was ready to check out. And it was touch and go. And when you had those people in the circle, it was kind of an amazing energy that was there, when they're on the edge of dying. And but just clinging to life with their fingertips now. And so those, you know, those images were there. It's the nighttime teepee shots at the end that I wanted in the movie. We had to manipulate, you know, use all sorts of filters to bring them up because the light that night was not very bright. And I stood out there until way into the morning. My partner Terry got pneumonia; he was freezing cold. And but there was an actual peyote ceremony going on there, and the medicine man or the road man that was there that night said, "I want this to be in your film." He said, "I want the spirit of what we're doing in here to be in your film." And so we worked very hard to get that. Yeah, and so those are actual shots, and so we're documenting. But it's a strange mixture of narrative and documentary. And see, I can't even say the word right. But yeah. So did that answer your question?
I hope it answers some questions out there.
Yeah. You know, in the interviews, which strike me as, you know, pretty brutally honest at moments, some of these people were willing to be that vulnerable. That came from us all having sat through some pretty dark moments together. And so they trusted me. You know, they said, "I'm willing to go into that place, you know, in front of the world and show them, you know, where you've got to go if you want to get out of these places." And so, you know, there was a lot of courage on that part. And I was scared to death when we premiered the film and they all showed up.
I was going to ask you about that. The film was premiered at the Salt Lake Arts Center in May, and many of these people were there. It was very interesting to see the film there and then see the people afterwards. And some of them changed quite a bit from how they looked in the film, mostly kind of a lightening of their spirits, it seems, that I detected and spoke with some of them. And what I'm wondering is, in your contact with them after that screening, did they have insights about either their own lives or insights on what the film meant to them personally that they told you about?
No.
And the answer to that is no.
I was scared. I kept away from them.
I see.
No, you know, we hugged and whatnot, but we didn't spend a lot of time.
Well, the one man, the blonde man who was there that night, we spoke to briefly, and he expressed some feeling that this film was just a furthering of the process he'd been through and would communicate a message that he cared deeply about other people understanding what they had gone through and simply maybe connecting with you know, their own selves by looking at the film. I mean, you know, we can't help but when we look at this film think about our own lives and think where we are and where we'd like to be and where we've been and where we might want to go. I mean, there's a couple of scenes in the film that even though I know they're coming and I'm steeled for them, it breaks me up every time. I mean, I audibly sobbed a couple of times while watching it again this time, and I'm not ashamed of that. I mean, it felt like real stuff, because it is real stuff, you know. Well, where do you want to go with this? Shall we start, open it to the audience? All right, Lorraine, come on up. Yep, that's what we do in this place.
I really loved the music, and I really was intrigued by that combination of the Native American flute kind of music and the LDS hymns that are familiar to me. And so this leads into the real question that I have, which is how does, in this context that we're in right now, how does the LDS Church play a role in this process for you?
For me, personally.
Yeah, or for anyone.
Yeah, actually, a number of the people there in the ceremonies were LDS. The one older man who talked about softening his heart towards his children was a stake high councilman in California, and you know, retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. So he's not the kind of person you expect exactly to see at these gatherings. We had an incredible cross-section of people there. Basically, they thought their lives, you know, something wasn't working, like I said, and they didn't know how to fix them, and this seemed to answer that. That's what brought them there. In terms of being LDS and for me and how this connects with that, my brother-in-law saw the film, and I was really curious. He's a financial type person, you know, a businessman, a bishop. He's a convert to the church. He's been like a bishop 4 or 5 times. I mean, they immediately grabbed onto this guy. And, you know, he saw the film, and his comment was, "All truth is circumscribed in one." And he recognized the truth in it, you know. In the Book of Mormon, in Ether, it says that anything that draws us to God is of God. Anything that is good, you know, is of God. And what I saw were people, you know, turning away from their addictions, not just the drug addictions, but all the addictions, the obsessions and things like that that kept them from living their lives and being in their relationships. I mean, it's a wonderful thing when you go into a ceremony and you say, "I do this for all my relations." And at some point, you know, 4 or 5 ceremonies down the road, you start to think, what does that phrase mean that I, you know, say each time? And you realize your relations are everything, you know. It starts with yourself and moves out to your family and your friends and your communities, but everything. And also to all the animals and creatures and everything, you know, and that you're there for that. You're part of that. And you're there to get better so that you can be a part of all that, that web of things. And I saw nothing, you know, in all of that that went against my beliefs as an active LDS person, which I am. So I know there have been a few people in my wards, you know, who thought that might be a contradiction and wondered how I could be doing these things. But I don't see any difference. In those ceremonies, the Spirit was there at times talking to me, sometimes for myself, and sometimes to help other people. You know, who were just struggling with something. And usually what it was is they, you know, come to you and say, "Okay, show them how to do it." You know, don't tell them how to do it. Show them how to do it. And which was really hard in those ceremonies. Sometimes that meant you had to take more medicine. And there's nothing, there are moments in those ceremonies that is an inconceivable thought to you. You know, inconceivable. But, you put all your faith together, you focus on the fire, you know, and you do it. And, you know, I saw sometimes, you know, that example helped some other people, and their example helped me, but I saw no inconsistency. So, absolutely. When I came out of the ceremonies, the scriptures made sense to me. Didn't it? Yeah. I'll tell you.
I mean, yeah. I need something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was incredible. I read things, and I said, "Oh, wow!" You know, that makes sense. That's my experience now, and that was probably, you know, I mean, that showed me something, I guess, about that. But, and I think of if I were to narrow it down to, you know, there is in Ether in the Book of Mormon one scripture, Ether 12:27, which actually is the epitome of what went on there. And I can never quote these things verbatim, but basically it says, if men come unto me, I will show unto them their weaknesses. And I give them their weaknesses that they might be humble. And then it goes on, ultimately say, I will make their weak things strong. And that's what I saw happen. And to me, the essence of the experience was kind of comes down to this, that Bob Jonas, you talk about Bob Jonas, is a man who was abandoned by his mother when he was 3 years old. The other guy that was in there, both of them had been in prison together. We had a number of prison men. Men had been in prison in these ceremonies. Both had been abandoned by their mothers. And to survive that experience, at some, you know, early in their lives, they began to lie to themselves. They took on a lie. And that lie helped them to survive, you know, through that experience. But it crippled them later in life. you know. As time went on, their anger grew, you know, their despair grew, and the lie served them less and less. And those men came to a point where they became violent with it, their anger and everything. Yeah, that's amazing. They're both, well, Randy joined the church. The guy who murdered, he was in a fight here in Salt Lake, picked up a 2x4 and killed a man with one blow. That's how much anger he had in him, you know. Bob Jonas could have done it. When you looked into his eyes in those early ceremonies, he scared me, you know, and you pick up a little bit of that there, you know. Both of those men are active in the LDS church now, which is incredible for them. But and I never, I'm not a missionary, but it was a great thing for them. But, yeah.
It's one thing to make a decision to go through or enter the process that your son conceived, but it's quite another to consider making an artwork about that experience before you've had it. So would you just say a little bit about the strategy, that is, the conception of the work, when that occurred, and how you were able to map out having enough material or the right kind of material to tell the story so magnificently?
You want to do it?
Yeah. Well, they had so much material. They had 100 tapes, 150 hours of tape. So it wasn't not having enough material. But at some point, it would have been really easy to make a very traditional documentary film. I mean, I think you can all see that. There were all these issues involved. Peyote, the legal uses of peyote, the whole thing of the Aquava Church falling apart. There were all these stories, and at the beginning, Paul Swenson can tell you because he saw early versions, we tried to do all of them. We had 5 stories going on. And then we began to get feedback. We'd have these little groups and we'd have screenings, and people, more and more the feedback we got was, it's the people's stories we're interested in. Yeah, you can have a little bit of this, this is good background, but we don't want to lose sight of the people like we are. And we want to know what happened to the people. And so we began, Paul made, I think, a really courageous choice at one point, which was, I'm not going to tell the traditional documentary story, which is a very removed, distant, objective story. I am going to tell this from a different viewpoint. I'm going to tell my story with all of these other stories. And he's gotten a lot of criticism for it from some places because they say, well, this is not objective. It isn't a documentary. But it was a very conscious decision at some point based on feedback he was getting that this is what we want to know. So I don't know if that answers your question, but there was a huge amount of material, and it was, once they made a choice to not try to tell all those stories, it became a little bit simpler.
And I'll just say one thing. This is the last film I set out to make. This is not, I wanted the objective story. I was going to have scientists, and I was going to have all this stuff. There's that sweat, or the sweat lodge scene, after when I'm there, you know, after the sweat lodge, I swore that would never see the light of day. And, you know, and then it just, the film just took a life of its own, you know, and just said, no, this is it, this is it, can you come with this? You know, and it took me a long time to come with it. I just, you know, but so kicking and screaming, yeah. You know, just, and I just, yeah. You know, there's Gary's right behind you, and, but yeah.
I'm interested in the way you were able to make a success of this experience where others weren't, and you've. I think you've answered the question to a large extent. One of the things that really impressed me is that it seemed that each step of the way it was important that you were not doing this alone. That this is the kind of thing that often we try to do alone with the help of you know, spiritual, going beyond ourselves and so forth. But the fact that your interaction with these other people was a really critical part of it, up to the point that you, the last point where your son came. Can you just comment on that? Am I on the right? I think that's probably as important an ingredient in the success as there was.
Yeah, I think one of the great tragedies of our time is how isolated we are. In smaller communities, you know, I think it was easier probably for people to form a more intimate community. And I hate to be critical, but even in our Mormon world, our wards are not very intimate. And, you know, I can't imagine going to a sacrament meeting and all of us getting in a circle and starting to throw up and talking about our, you know, what goes on in our lives, really, you know. And, but yeah, it was incredibly helpful having this community there and knowing, you know, that, I mean, you really had this sense of, yeah, that guy's been to prison, you know, this person's been, you know, into drugs heavily and this and that and this and that. It makes no difference, you know. At this moment, I'm in so much pain, you know, and that person's helping me, you know. And it just broke all those, you know, while we were there for just a little while, it just broke down all those things that kept us separate, and we formed a community. And there was tremendous strength in that community. And I could never understand, I don't think I could ever express what that meant, you know, other than you'd be there and you'd know it. But yeah, community. You know, and obviously my son's role right there at the end. You know, and that's always a hard moment for me to talk about. Yeah. You know, and there were people around that circle who were praying for me at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, you made thousands of editorial decisions, and there's this one that was so chilling to me, I have to ask you about it. The implosion of those two smokestacks at the beginning, obviously you took that picture long before September 11th, but I'm from New York, I'm sorry. Now you must have decided to leave that in or take it out at some point.
It was a conscious choice, and I thought after September 11th, and I ran that again, I thought, oh no, that's such an important image. You know, but I thought, as a nation, this is a path we need to walk, you know. We need to start getting rid of those lies that we carry with us, you know, and just tell the truth, you know, start to see things clearly. And I feel, you know, again, I don't want to politicize this a whole lot, but that's such an interesting event, the Twin Towers, the collapse of it. You know, I think, like with everybody else, I wept that day for the people who died. But also, we as a nation carry some lies about that whole thing. And we're not willing to look at them. And I'm afraid we doom ourselves to those types of experiences again unless we're willing to do that. And so I left it in, you know. Wondering if anybody would ever notice. How many actually drew that? I mean, saw that? Yeah, okay. Okay.
I did not immediately. We want to take Lori Winder Stromberg's question, but something just occurred to me. 2 days ago, we were in a pre-Sunstone workshop with Carolyn Pearson, who is speaking tomorrow about her new book, Synchronicities, and she spoke somewhat of that. 2 days ago, synchronicities, what an interesting topic. This synchronicity, not a happy one, in a way, to remind us of those towers. And yet, as Paul says, truth is told through synchronicities of that kind sometimes. And here's a brighter synchronicity. The phrase, for all my relations, which is a Native American phrase. I want to recommend to you a CD by a local singer-songwriter, Marv Hamilton. The name of the CD is A Wing and a Prayer, but on that CD is a song called Aho, For All My Relations, and it speaks so eloquently of the very thing this film speaks of that it's a very powerful song. So take a listen to that. Get a hold of that CD. Lori.
I'll give you three. Okay. One, I'm interested in Anne's response to the ceremony, going through the whole process, and how, what it meant to you, if it had the same sort of effect. Secondly, I am interested in knowing more about the collapse of Aqaba and the Aqlava, like baklava, only without the B. Okay. And I'm also curious about this whole idea of, I have this sort of negative initial response to adopting others, co-opting other rituals. I have a very good friend who's Native American, also Mormon. And, I mean, even she was raised by white parents. And so in a way, you know, one of the things that she and I have talked about is that whole notion of, you know, she's had to go back and rediscover culture. Can you ever really sort of get it all, you know, when you co-opt or later come to another culture's rituals and that sort of thing. So I'm curious about that whole idea of using that. Do you feel weird about that when you're involved in the ceremony? And also, I mean, obviously there are mixed feelings, as you indicated. I'm curious a little bit to, if you could expand for us a little more on that whole notion, you know, the feelings of Native American peoples as to what you guys are doing.
Okay, I'll just quickly get rid of the first one. Number one, I wasn't looking for a cultural experience. Most of these people were not. We're not trying to become Indians, nor could we ever know what their experience would be in doing these ceremonies. So right off the bat, I just, that question. I mean, second thing is, there is no such thing as a pure ceremony anywhere. We've impacted each other everywhere around the globe from the beginning of ceremonies. You know, one group coming in contact with another and another and another. The Apache took on the ceremony, some of the ceremonies of the Pueblo Indians, because they found them effective, you know. I found these ceremonies effective. No comment. But anyway, so I wasn't looking for a cultural experience. If you want to go out and learn what it is to be an Indian, you know, that's a different thing. You know, but for me, I was looking for access to a spirit that could help me change my life in some way. My first impulse was to help my son, and then I found that. You know, it's what James said to me at the beginning. If you want to help your son, show him how to get better yourself. Don't tell him how, don't give him advice. Just go ahead and show him, you know, how it is to get better. And so that's what I was looking for in those ceremonies. And it could have been anything, you know. But, so you had a question about Anne's.
I don't like to talk. Well, I like Paul. I mean, I want you people to realize this was the last thing we were going to do. I mean, it seemed new agey. It seemed flaky. All of you who know Lynn Whiteside, she's one of our dearest friends, and she was doing it, and she kept saying, come on, it's great, it's great. And we kept saying, no, I'll never do that. But when Paul was invited by an old college roommate to come to a ceremony where his friend, his son, who'd been a heroin addict, they were trying to help him, and Paul said, I'm impressed. He was amazed. He thought it would be flaky and weird. And he said, I'm really impressed with these people. And one thing you should know is that James Mooney, the leader shown in there, is a Mormon. You know, so he's not just a Native American. He's a Mormon. And he's adapted these ceremonies to try to be kind of what they call bridging ceremonies to help non-Natives access some of this spirituality. So it isn't totally a traditional kind of ceremony, whatever that is. But anyway, my experience was very leery, and but when your child is in that much pain and that much trouble, you really will try anything that you can do, and you get very humble. And I found the ceremonies really helpful, and I learned a lot. I sat with my son all night. I mean, 16 hours in a teepee together. Just he and I went to one of these, and that was an amazing experience to sit together like that and help each other and talk and be that close. So they were amazing experiences, but we don't do them anymore, for one thing. We did them, they helped us. We don't keep doing them. Paul will still do sweat lodges from time to time, but that we're kind of past that phase. And Aqaba is really disintegrated. You know, it's the state Supreme Court is what? They're
hearing a motion to dismiss.
Right, they're trying to get the charges dismissed, and it's up before the state Supreme Court. The whole issue is, can you really say who can belong to a certain religion or not? If you're going to give privilege to Native American religion, can you really say no one but a Native American can have access to this spirituality? So it's up before the state Supreme Court right now. But the organization has pretty much disintegrated.
So what impact did the ceremonies have on you?
They were, you know, what's interesting about the ceremonies is that they keep working. I mean, it's not like you do them and then it's over, and I find it still working in me years later. I don't know how to explain that, but there's something it accessed or opened up for me that I can go back to all the time. The biggest impact they had on me was it restored my son to me, who was lost, really lost. I thought he wouldn't live. And it's a pretty big thing. And my husband, really, who was also pretty lost. And it has been about 3 or 4 years now, and the change in him is still solid, and the change in our family's lives because of that is a night and day kind of change.
You got sick?
Yeah, I got sick. It's really sick, really hard. Yeah, yeah, just stuff, lies, old fears, all the stuff he talked about. I got sick. Yep. It's not fun.
Christian?
I have two questions that actually have nothing to do with the movie. The first one is how much of this sort of positive trauma that, you know, you have an experience and it keeps on having these positive echoes, is or can be adopted by modern psychotherapy. I remember being real jealous of all the positive changes happening in your life and talking with my own therapist about this and him saying, oh, there's obviously no credence to go with this. And I guess that's more white expansionism coming out. But the second question is, what do you see as the most dramatic war story coming out of those teepees? What was the best thing you saw out of there?
Well, I'll answer the first one, and you can be thinking about the second. I think psychotherapy is great. You know, I think if it can connect you, whatever can connect you, whatever works for you. You know, I know my mother saw this, and she had a really hard time. She's a very active Mormon and more conventional, and it really shook her. And for not just the obvious reason, her reply was, "Well, can't we get this through the church?" And my response was, "Yeah, if you can, do it." You know, but one big difference in these ceremonies for me was they're so physical. And in the church, we don't bring our bodies into it as much. And so much of what resides in us is in our bodies, old things, you know. And this physicalness of these sweat lodges and these ceremonies contacted that in our bodies. And that was, I think, a huge difference that you don't get necessarily usually in psychotherapy and in some other things. But whatever works for you, and I'd say do it all, you know, whatever helps you. Follow that path, and there may be some times in your life that one thing will help, and then, you know, you move on to something else. But I will say, through it all, there was a lot of prayer and fasting, and it wasn't like we abandoned our religion and went to this. It was just added to it. So
have you thought of a great war story?
I mean, I don't even know what that is. War story. You know, the Kai story. I just Yeah, and I would say, you know, we interviewed in California, we interviewed a therapist, part of my grand scheme to have therapists talk about all this stuff, and a therapist who'd gone through a couple of ceremonies, and she said, she was very articulate and wonderful, she said, in our therapy, we emphasize talking far too much. We sit and we just talk and talk and talk. She said, what I like about these ceremonies is that when you come up against your issues, it's not subtle. He said, I mean, if you're sitting there feeling really sick, you know, it's not subtle. And, you know, or when you're in a sweat lodge and you're just feeling absolute panic, there's no subtlety in it. You know you're coming up against it. Of course, you can say to yourself, well, I'm just a claustrophobic sort of person, you know. And, you know, but the next question that they'll ask you is, why are you a claustrophobic person? You know, what's that all about? And I've seen people determined to stay in the sweat lodge, going through hell in the sweat lodge, and actually disassociating and passing out, coming back awake, trying to talk again, and passing out completely, and then coming back again, just disassociating. But there was no doubt in her mind that she was running up against a big issue in her life, you know, something that she, you know, she's been carrying, that's been crippling her life all the way along. And she was getting it in a very unsubtle way. Same thing in the sweat lodge. And that's one of the differences with psychotherapy, which I respect. But there's just too much emphasis on intellectualizing it, getting it clear here in your head, you know, forgetting the fact that, you know, a large part of your body is just unconnected to this, disconnected. War stories. What does that mean, a war story?
It's probably in the film.
Which one?
It's probably already in the film.
Yeah, I said
But there were some amazing moments which we never could get that were dramatic. There was a one night you suggested this young man who'd come from a good LDS family, been hooked on heroin for quite some time, and just his life was spiraling down. This is a different one from the trees up in the woods. But I clearly heard a voice that said to help him, show him the way. So I took a whole lot of medicine and had a hard, hard experience. But I kind of pushed my way through it. And then the rest of the night I spent over with him. He refused to take medicine, refused to take any more medicine. Now this little ball of medicine, you know, which tasted so vile, you know, was really representative at that moment of whether he was willing to re-enter the process of life or whether he was going to stand back the way he'd been doing for years, using a drug to mitigate that experience, keep him out of it. And he'd take this medicine and put it in his mouth, and he'd hold it there, and then he'd spit it out again, you know? And we went, this was hours. This went on for hours. And I took more medicine to show him how to do it. And another guy came over, and he did too. And he couldn't do it, couldn't do it, couldn't do it. And the sun was just about to start coming up early in the morning, and he finally took it, and it went down, you know? And he ended his heroin addiction, you know? He'd made a clear decision. This was a line for him, you know? He knew it inside. That's why it had been so hard to take. He knew inside what he was really choosing to do, you know, and it was the beginning of his process. It wasn't an easy process, stepping in a clean and clear one, but this guy has rebuilt his life just bit by bit by bit. The woman at the end, very similar, you know, rebuilt her life step by step, just, you know, came just a dramatic, for me, dramatic moment.
In our Mormon culture or doctrine, we often hear that it's the members that are going to rescue the Native Americans, the Lamanites, that we'll be the nursing mothers and the nursing fathers and carry them on our backs. And the more I learn about my Native American friends and their cultures, I've been studying the Northwest Shoshone cultures. I've run into some amazing and beautiful songs, Naraya songs, connection with the earth and healing and renewal, and I'm thinking, whoa, this is something I want. You know, the more I learn about that, the more significant the scripture becomes and the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. How do you see the role of Native Americans in the winding up scene?
See, I have kind of a different interpretation after all of this of what we call the fullness of the gospel. I think the great blessing of our time is that we have access to so much, you know, from the east, the west, the north, the south, and part of that access is what the Native Americans carry with them. You know, it's like a whole bunch of pieces of a puzzle, and if you can, you know, and each little piece allows its own little access into, you know, the greater picture of life, the fuller picture of life. And so, you know, the Native Americans have definitely, you know, definitely have one of those pieces. And they're carrying something that we've forgotten about, you know, that our ancestors probably had a long time ago. And but we've forgotten it, you know, with the way things have happened through Western European culture into America and whatnot, the way we've gone, we've forgotten those things. And they're really important things to remember. And so, you know, I never knew. You know, I'm sure we have something to teach fans, but, you know, at the moment, I for some time felt the other way around. So, you know.
It looks like we've got about 5 minutes if there are more questions.
I admire your courage for what you did for this. Your initial reason was for your son. As I see this film all the way through it, I was eager to hear more of how he was doing. Was it deliberate that you did not show that much? Was it, well, just why did we not see more about the son's journey? And then at the final end, did you wonder about sharing this with the world, if it would take away from what your son had benefited from this experience? You are mature adults that have gained even more awareness and maturity, but your son is at another level, and I'd like you to just talk a little bit about the son.
Well, before Paul made this film, he asked our son whether he asked for his permission to do it, because he knew I was, you know, exposing him, and he gave that permission. He's not real thrilled about the film. I mean, he hasn't even seen the film, frankly. And people say, well, why would he be embarrassed? He's, you know, he's a hero in the film. He comes across so well in the film. But I just ask you to ask yourself, if you were 21, 22 years old, and your dad made a film about your depression and showed it to a whole bunch of people, how you would feel about it. And it's hard for him. He wants to be great in the world. He wants to be strong and cool and all those things that age of college-age kid wants to be, and he doesn't want to be known for having had this problem, even though he came through so wonderfully with it. So he, what would you say? He allows it. You know, he allows the film, he allows this all, but he doesn't really like to participate, and he declined to be further, you know, interviewed any more than he just does appear in the film. And he's doing incredibly well, by the way. He just graduated from Brandeis University with the highest honors, and is you know, trying to figure out what to do next, but is much, much happier. He's just doing great. But do you have anything else?
I mean, just in answer to that, though, because we've heard that before, and you know, number one, he was given only one job in these ceremonies: watch your father. You don't have to do anything else; just watch your father. And it was only the beginning of that process, the ceremonies for him, you know. And so the ceremonies, as far as his path, his journey, it really is you couldn't talk about it in a way, you know, not in this way, you know. And it really, that night when he turned to me and said, get better yourself and show them how it's done. You know, it changed everything. Then the ceremonies became about me trying to find out what I was doing, that the film's about. But, so it really isn't a film about my son. You know? Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Can we put that on the jacket of the? one last. Maybe this is the last comment about that. But the one thing I would say is that we spend too much time looking at others, and what they need to do. And what became clear for me is, you want to heal your families, heal yourself. Don't focus on what other people are doing in your family. Focus on yourself and get better yourself, and then don't preach to them about it. Just live your life, and that's good enough. They're watching you. His job was to watch me, still is. And yeah, thanks. But anyway.
Thank you all for coming and participating.